You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. On my bookshelf this week, I got a couple of big old coffee table books. In a little while, we'll talk with Pat Thomas about the life of Jerry Rubin. But first, animation historian Mindy Johnson is here, and she is the author of several books on animation, and her newest is a beautiful coffee table book that is really a work of art in itself. It's also very timely, and it's called Ink and Paint, The Women of Walt Disney's Animation. Mindy Johnson, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thanks so much, Gary. It's a real pleasure.
You know, judging from the Disney studio histories of the past, one might think that The Women of Walt Disney's Animation could be like a pamphlet. But you discovered that there are a lot of untold stories here.
It's a very rich history. I admit it. When I began this volume, I underestimated it because that's all we knew. That's all anyone knew, is that it was exactly as you said, maybe a pamphlet or a sentence or two about what was accomplished there. But about 8 months into my research, I learned quickly this was an incredibly rich, deep, and extraordinary aspect of animation that had never been explored before. But even going beyond the world of ink and paint to where women were and what their roles were within animation.
Well, you know, I have heard of Mary Blair, and in fact, I knew her when I first moved to Santa Cruz, and she and her husband, Lee Blair, lived here. And she was a terrific lady. And as I always understood it, she was the first female animator that went upstairs, that all the women that worked at Disney worked downstairs.
Well, actually, no. There were hundreds of women at the studio before Mary arrived, and in terms of working upstairs in the upper echelon, there were a number of women, even going back to several years before Mary arrived. But Mary certainly was sort of a favored artist there at the studio, and rightfully so. Her artistry, her sense of color, just such a marvelous approach to a unique style and a design approach to animation and applied to the great animated stories of the Walt Disney Studios. But there were several other key women in animation roles. Mary's work certainly was story and concept development artwork, things and art direction. But in terms of wielding pencils and animating, there were a number of women long before Mary.
Well, someone must have been the first. Who was it?
Well, many people believed it was Retta Scott, and certainly she was a very early female skirted animator, they were called at that time. But actually,
skirted animator.
Skirted animator. It was the 30s. So we have to sort of carefully recognize that we're in a very different time period and place it into a context. But there are women such as Viola Anderson, who is the first in-betweener, which would be an animator creating the animated drawings in between the key poses, the extreme poses that a lead animator might provide.
So let me just interrupt for 1 second, Mindy.
Sure.
So let's say in a minute of animation, how many drawings would the key animator do and how many would the in-betweener do?
Oh, that's hard to say. Depending on how the animation is being approached, if it's on every two frames or single frame animation, but roughly, the lead animator would do extreme poses, sort of the key positions that they want the movement to unfold within. And usually those are circled by the lead animator. So those are circle takes. And then in between there, getting those the drawings created that would define the movement in between these extreme poses would be an in-betweener. And that could be anywhere from 20 to 50 drawings, depending on how extreme the movement was, how long the scene might be, and what the character involved.
So an in-betweener has to be as skilled a draftsman as an animator.
Absolutely, very much so. And certainly versed within the style and the character, having a sense of the character and the movement and understanding just proficient and skilled as the lead animator, but with the ability to sort of almost anticipate what the lead animator is looking for in terms of movement and characterization.
Well, we the public always think of the actor playing the role as being the person providing the voice, but animators thought of the animator as being the actor who plays the part. Norm Ferguson, played Pluto or something like that. So were there in-betweeners who were attached to certain animators?
Oh, over the years? Sure, absolutely. In-betweeners and assistant animators. We want to clarify that role as well. You have Mary Schuster, who during the 1950s was working with Ward Kimball very closely as an assistant animator. Jane Fowler Boyd, who worked with Mark Davis on Maleficent. She actually even did live-action reference modeling for Maleficent.
So she not only drew her, but she played her, is what you're saying?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, there are some wonderful photographs of her. Eleanor Audley, of course, provided the great vocalizations for Maleficent, but Jane Fowler Boyd is in the costume and did some wonderful reference for the character as well.
And there's some great pictures of that in your book.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's some wonderful women. Retta Davidson, the other Retta, was a tremendous assistant animator. And people forget that not only was it difficult for women to move into a lead animation position, but men as well. Walt had his 9 old men of animation. He had his lead artists who that he could count on, who knew what they were doing. And that's important, certainly, but not only was it difficult for women to move up to a lead position, it was for men. So it's important to place that into context. But women certainly were there with a very strong presence and animating on virtually every film since Fantasia.
And did Walt Disney respect women animators in the same way that he respected men?
He did. He was very progressive for women. He is on record in the early 1930s as stating that, I don't know why, but women just don't seem to have the power for animation. But you have to remember that in the earliest of the 1930s, animation was mostly pratfalls and physical comedy and sight gags. So there was a lot of physical movement there. But as Disney is moving into feature film animation, this is where he starts to bring women on board in the story department. We see women moving into concept and development artwork and into writing, into editing, into all disciplines of animation, because he recognizes if I'm going to have audiences sitting for an hour and a half in a theater, we can't rely on physical comedy. There has to be pathos. There has to be emotion. And so he brings women in, recognizing that they have a lot to bring to the animated medium. And really, by the time we get to Pinocchio, we see the first female background artist, Miriam Wiley Sturrett. She does just beautiful, exquisite backgrounds and continues at the studio through into the mid-1940s, bringing some lovely sensibilities to the backgrounds. And a number of women, as the war approaches, a number of women then are brought in. But certainly by the time Walt's in production on Fantasia, women are everywhere. And in fact, in many ways, that's truly a woman's film. from the story and concept artistry, there are more women behind the scenes on that film than ever in animation, from Sylvia Holland and Ethel Kulsar and Faith Rukas and in their story and concept artwork, to Retta Scott, and Mildred Rossi and Viola Anderson and Ethel Kulsar doing quite a bit of color animation. And this is a term that sadly has been forgotten about, but in the earliest, late 30s, early 40s, color animation was its own sort of department or entity at Disney Studio, and really women made extraordinary advances in color, but they developed pastel approaches to be able to directly apply pastel to the celluloid, and therefore bypassing any kind of pencil artistry. So pastel could be applied directly to the cells, and you see a lot of this in the Toccata and Fugue segment there of Fantasia. This was developed by the women of the paint lab, who were master chemists. Mary Weiser and her team created an adhesive to spray to the celluloid so that pastel of chalk or even oil pastels were able to adhere to the cell, and then developed another adhesive level to spray to keep the pastel artistry adhered to the cell as it went through camera. And thus we have the Toccata and Fugue segment, as well as Chernobog. The wonderful lightning flashes of Chernobog is all this pastel technique, and that's accomplished by Mildred Rossi, who just did beautiful, stunning work on that. And it's moving color. So this term hasn't really been applied, but I was able to find documents, memos, talking about the color animator teams, color animation departments, and it was largely women working with this, but animating color. And truthfully, we actually have women in the ink and paint department who are animating color when we get to Snow White. The rouge technique, or the blend technique, as it was officially called, on her cheeks, to give her that dimensional, more of a human quality. That was developed by Mary Weiser and her teams in the paint labs, and it was a dye technique. There's a very charming story that the girls were applying rouge to the cells, but it was actually a dye technique developed by Mary and her teams. But the women had to animate that color as Snow White's face turned across the screen, as well as highlights in her hair of white, light, very subtle gray dry brush streaks within her hair to give her hair a sense of dimension and depth and separation.
So that wonderful story that we've always heard about the women downstairs applying their makeup right out of their purse, that's not true.
Yeah, no, unfortunately. Actually, I think where that stemmed from is a reporter had asked, supposedly Walt had asked, how are you able to do this so naturally? And with that, there were actually a couple of women who were able to animate the color as it moved across the cells. And they said, well, you know, we apply rouge to our own face every day. And so that's where the myth took off. But it actually was a dye technique of orange and pink dyes that were combined and then essentially applied directly to the cell with almost an industrial-sized Q-tip that was developed at the studio so that it would seep into the pores of the cell and then had to be carefully blended to achieve that natural effect and then carefully animated across multiple cells within an individual scene. So a really remarkable part of the story that few people realize.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking with Mindy Johnson, and she's just written this great book, which is just an absolutely beautiful book. And it's called Ink and Paint, The Women of Walt Disney's Animation. And Mindy Johnson, I have to ask a couple of questions that are timely. What about pay? Were the women paid reasonably? I see, you know, in some of the pictures, I can see dozens and dozens of women that worked at the studio. Could they make a career out of it? Were they well paid?
They could. Actually, when you consider that this is the 1930s and we're at the height of the Depression, I made a point of checking that myself. And in the 1930s, you could rent a very good-sized two-bedroom apartment for about $10 a month, $12 a month, depending on where you were living. A gallon of gas was 8 cents. Or 20 cents, a loaf of bread was 8 cents, but you would have painters getting about $15 or $12 a week. Oh, sorry, my fuzzy brain here with all these numbers. The women painters would get about $12 a week, and the inkers would make more. They'd get 15 a week, since their artistry really was calligraphic, and deservedly so. It was a very special skill and training and a level of artistry that was rarely accomplished. Animators had pencils and erasers all day, but these women had to get that stroke in exactitude and match it all the way across the scene, tapering a line in and out and achieving the right thin and thickness at any point within that curve. So inkers really, rightfully so, were paid a bit more. But many of the women actually were, it was a tremendous supplement to income. A couple of the ladies were breadwinners for their families, as far as the research that I've been digging into. So it was a very good job when you also consider that teachers were paid about the same rate. We do also have signs that an indication that women in different positions were being paid quite a bit more. For example, stenographers were making close to $30 a week. And as women moved into animation with the various roles, Walt is on record as stating in 1940 and early 1941, if a woman is doing the job, she's paid the job. So there were no breaks, no differentiations, just simply because they were women. So pretty remarkable when you consider the times and the economy of the day.
And, of course, the other question that's on everyone's mind nowadays, was there an animated casting couch?
No. There were certainly, you know, there was lots of dating and social activities and things. But this is where... There's a bit of an interesting perception. People think, oh, women were just relegated off into a corner. Interestingly enough, I came across a memo that was issued out stating as about the early 1940s, as more and more women are moving into the animation halls. And it was issued to the men of the in-between department stating, asking the gentlemen to please watch their language. Walt wanted to ensure that this was a comfortable place for women to work in. When in the late 1920s, the inking and painting aspect of animation was, there were men also doing that. In fact, at the very earliest days, Walt and Roy were right there pitching in, blackening in the cells along with the other animators in order to get the films out. But by the time you get to the 1930s, late 20s, 1930s, Hazel Sewell, who was the first woman to head a major department in animation, Walt put her to work, and she headed up what was called then the tracing and opaquing department. And Hazel discerned that it should be women. Women were actually better at this finalized aspect of animation. So she separated out the department into inkers and painters. And with that, with an all-female team, they were placed into their own separate building in 1935 Largely because since they were working on the celluloid, this was the final step before going to camera. And so the cells needed to be as pristine as possible. So the building was sort of built off into a far side of the studio where there was space. And men generally, or others at the studio generally, were not allowed over there because they needed to keep the space as clean as possible to eliminate dust and other elements that might adhere to the cells or to slow down and hamper the final production as stage of animation. So with that sort of off-limits quality, this is where we get to, you know, the funny nicknames of the nunnery and the monastery, or, you know, they have silly names for it. But they were pretty much off-limits just simply to protect the cells as they were heading off to camera. That's where, you know, you put men and women working together, you're going to have social interaction. And for many of the women, it was a wonderful place to, you know, have a social life and to meet interesting men and to date. And so there was a lot of activities and social clubs and newsletters and that sort of thing going on. But as far as a casting couch, no. There would be silly drawings going back and forth, but the girls pretty much kept each other tucked away in doing their work and pretty well protected, pretty well guarded.
So the Disney Studios, unique in the annals of Hollywood studios, apparently.
Well, very much, I think. Certainly as you look at other studios, and within the book I did have a few interviews from women who'd worked at other studios during the different decades and time periods. And it was interesting to hear their side of their stories and experiences, where women could maybe move a little faster in other divisions. It's still, there was a lot of problems, a lot of harassment, a lot of sexism going on industry-wide. It sadly is the nature of the time period as well and the prevailing attitudes. But for the most part, surprisingly, when you look at it from that context, and Walt was very progressive and very protective and really worked to ensure that the women were comfortable. In fact, amongst the other studios, Disney's studio was considered the country club. If you were working there, you were at the country club. It was a comfortable environment and safe and clean and Walt took pride in that.
Well, Mindy Johnson, as the years went by and more women became involved in animation, is there a visible change in the nature of the animated features? Is there one you can say, oh, you know, this film definitely shows the influence of women?
Well, Fantasia would be the first, most definitely. Women were in probably almost every area and every facet of production on that film. And when you see some of the early storyboard pieces and development work by Ethel Coulter, Sylvia Holland, Faith Rukas, and many of the other women there, it really is a woman's film. It also featured the first female music editor in Hollywood. Her name was Louisa Field. Hollywood itself had never had a woman music editor, and Walt brought her in on Fantasia. Pretty remarkable placement. But from there, from Fantasia, we really start to see women moving everywhere, at least within Disney. Sadly, the records at many of the other studios are scattered to the winds, but in the research, which I'm continuing into as many other studios as I can get information, there really weren't as many women in roles, as wide a level of roles, as there were at Disney. Certainly, there were key women at other studios all throughout the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and by the mid-40s, we see women in a fairly large number establishing their own studios, or partners at least, within their own studios. In the early 30s, we have experimental women animators And the research on this is continuing. It's sadly a fairly little is known, but I'm working to change that. So I would definitely mark Fantasia as a real turning point for women.
Well, what about today in animation? I know that sort of hand-drawn animation is kind of a thing of the past now, sadly, but are there a lot of women involved in animation today?
There is. Right now, we're at a really exciting turning point. There are more women training and in many of the wonderful animation programs. And you have to remember, too, that it's just within the last maybe 15 to 20 years that we've started to see an expansion of animation programs within many of the colleges and art schools. Prior to that, you had maybe CalArts. And that might have been it. So training for this role just not as prevalent, not as widely known. And sadly, those myths of only men are animators have lingered for too long. In fact, they sadly still linger, and we need to change it. But right now, there are more women studying animation in some schools than there are men. The industry, however, does need to shift. And there are efforts underway to make that change, to get these women placed into roles, in wide ranges of roles, in so many facets of animation. And animation is now at its widest reach ever. So we have a really exciting number of films available, running for Academy consideration, feature-length animated films. Every year, the number increases more and more, which is really exciting. And it's just time. There certainly is enough work out there. People are realizing that women are capable of telling and have extraordinary stories to tell. So it's, I think, a matter of getting our unconscious bias to change, to become enlightened about that, and to think, you know, when considering talent and who to bring on board for production, to actively seek out women and to shift the numbers. And as I said, there are great efforts underway now. So it'll be exciting to see, hopefully, where this changes in the coming years.
Well, this book, it's absolutely beautiful. It's called Ink and Paint, The Women of Walt Disney's Animation, and the author, my guest, Minnie Johnson. Minnie Johnson, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, great pleasure. Thanks so much for all you do, Gary. Thank you.
Minnie Johnson. Her book is called Ink and Paint, The Women of Walt Disney's Animation. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. And we turn now to Pat Thomas. Pat Thomas is an historian of American music, popular culture, and politics. He's written several books, and the latest is a mammoth work on the counterculture of the 1960s through the eyes of one of that culture's architects and most controversial figures, Jerry Rubin. The book is called Did It! From Yippie to Yuppie, Jerry Rubin, an American Revolutionary. Pat Thomas, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, it's great chatting with you this afternoon, and I look forward to diving in here.
All right. Well, you know, there are some people out there who might not remember Jerry Rubin, so tell us who he was.
Well, in short, Jerry was an anti-Vietnam War activist throughout the 60s and early 70s. He challenged LBJ and Nixon and Hoover. He also championed the Black Panther Party. There were a number of things that he did. One was throwing money on the New York Stock Exchange, which caused the Wall Street traders to stop trading for a day. There was an act in October 67 of trying to levitate the Pentagon, so to speak. But most infamously, he led the protests in Chicago in August of 68, the Democratic Convention, trying to convince the Democratic Party to pull out of Vietnam, and that led to the Chicago 8 trial a year later, in which Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman, Tom Hayden, Bobby Seale, and others were charged with trying to start these riots.
And you've decided now, in 2017, to write a book about him. What led to that?
Well, there were a few things. You know, Jerry, his partner in crime, so to speak, was a guy named Abby Hoffman, and together they were known as the Yippies. Abby has had several books written about him, and I realized that Jerry never had. And then the other thing is some of you may have noticed that the political climate has shifted to sort of a Nixon-like regime, and I felt like it was time to remind people of some of the great radical activists, progressive radicals of the 1960s.
So you see a message for today's youth in Jerry Rubin's story?
It's not just a message for today's youth. The scope of the book is a little wider than Jerry. I interviewed almost 100 people. I folded in many of Jerry's friends. He was friends with Norman Mailer, Allen Ginsberg, Phil Oakes. And it's sort of a little bit of the story of the baby boomers, which is that they're activists in the 1960s. Jerry and many others got into things like yoga and EST and self-help in the 1970s. And then Jerry wound up on Wall Street himself in the 1980s, marketing solar panels and green energy. So it's not just Jerry's story. I think it's the story of a whole generation of people. And the book is really aimed, I think, at Jerry's peers and contemporaries more than anything else.
You know, I met Jerry Rubin once. He came to Santa Cruz to signed copies of a book, and he thought he was just going to have a book signing, you know, and there were all these people, and they were like shouting questions at him and really kind of challenging him. I think people saw him as selling out and all that.
Well, Jerry was polarizing because, you know, fellow liberals in the 60s thought that Jerry's brand of humor, you know, basically Jerry was using sex, drugs, and rock and roll to protest the Vietnam War. And, you know, some people didn't like that. And then later, people accused him of selling out and turning to the right. And what I found out was very interesting. Jerry never became a Republican, never became a right-winger. He became a liberal Democrat like Tom Hayden, a guy wearing a tie. And as I mentioned earlier, he wasn't selling shares of Exxon Oil on Wall Street. He was marketing solar panels in 1980 before anyone really wanted to hear about that. So that was another reason I wrote the book, is to kind of set the record straight. There's almost everyone accuses Jerry of selling out, and I just don't feel that's the case.
You know, I remember also one of my strong memories of Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman was when John Lennon and Yoko Ono co-hosted the Mike Douglas show. It was one of the most you know, crazy things. And they had Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman on the show.
Well, yeah, what happened was Yoko sort of politicized John in England in 1969 and 1970. And in 1971, John and Yoko moved to New York City with the express purpose of protesting the Vietnam War. They immediately became friends with Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman. And Jerry was responsible for introducing John to the band Elephant's Memory, which led to the recording of a political album known as Sometime in New York City. And so for about 18 months, Jerry and John Lennon are sort of inseparable. And for those who are Beatles fans, you may remember then Lennon spent the next 5 years trying to not get deported for his political actions, and that was Nixon's way of trying to neutralize Lennon's political activities.
That's some pretty funny, pretty funny shows, those Mike Douglas shows.
Welcome to the Mike Douglas Show. This is John Lennon
and Yoko Ono.
We're Mike's co-host this week, and with us on today's show will be Jerry Rubin.
What is the new Jerry Rubin thinking about these days?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. We're going to support Nixon for president because by going to China, he's furthering communist revolutions throughout the world and also encouraging communism at home. Anything to get elected, even though it's not appreciated by the right wing, it's appreciated by the left. I'm just kidding. I'm really just kidding. What he's really done is automate the war in Vietnam so that it's machines killing people. Created a situation where 43 people can be murdered at Attica. create a situation where four kids can be killed at Kent State and people are afraid, scared.
You really believe he created that situation?
It's the atmosphere in the country is one of just death.
I mean, but you said people, he created. You said he created.
Oh, I think his administration did, and he's the symbol of it. And so I'm working very hard with people all over the country to defeat Nixon. I think that's the most important thing.
You're not going to vote for him, though.
No, not going to vote for him at all.
Well, why the change, Jerry?
Well, no.
What's different in you and the movement? Like, let's say people thought the movement had died, you know?
Yes. What is the movement?
And B, did it die? And what are the differences in it now than 4 years ago?
Yeah, can you explain that? Well, I need an hour. Well, the movement is everybody, I hope, watching television. You know, it doesn't have any narrow definition.
Okay, beautiful.
You know, and it's all the black people right now in jail who I know watch this show, because when I was in jail, the show was on. And so I want to give a love call to all the black people who are now in jail. And it's all the students and all people that believe that this country is, since it's capitalist, is inherently oppressive and also tries to dominate the world. I was in Chile this summer and I saw how the United States dominates the economy of Chile. Now, the way the movement's changed is the rhetoric has gone calmer because the repression is so heavy that anybody who does anything gets arrested, jailed, killed, that people are like very pessimistic.
From February 1972, that was The Mike Douglas Show with guest hosts John Lennon and Yoko Ono and their guest, Jerry Rubin, who was the subject of a new book called Did It, From Yippie to Yuppie, Jerry Rubin, an American Revolutionary, by Pat Thomas, my guest.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things my book does is it's, you know, for readers who obviously can't see it, since this is radio, not TV, it's a giant 5-pound coffee table book with about 500 photos, and about 100 interviews, including many interviews with people that were close to John Lennon at the time that have never spoken before. So, you know, you don't have to be a Jerry Rubin fan to buy the book. It's a much wider scope than that. There's something in there for music fans and other people interested in the counterculture in general.
A lot of beautiful photographs. And one of the strips of photographs that I love is this picture of Phil Oakes in his prime, 1968, playing at the protest there. And, you know, that those protests had a very devastating effect on Phil Oakes. His next album, Rehearsals for Retirement, had his own gravestone on the front cover, in which he said that he died in 1968. And in 1976, he took his own life. It was a very demoralizing experience for him.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the people that I interviewed really lost faith, not necessarily in 1968, but they really lost faith in 1972 when Nixon was reelected by a landslide. And a lot of activists at that point decided to kind of drop out of the movement. They, you know, some went back to school, you know, people got married, had kids, kind of got on with their lives. And again, you know, bring this back around to Jerry Rubin, that's sort of what Jerry did. He just simply, you know, he was exhausted. It had been an incredible 4-year run from 68 to 72. You know, he got punched in the face many times. He got thrown in jail many times. And, you know, he really needed to recharge his batteries and go off to doing, you know, something else. Which many people did. They just weren't famous like Jerry, and so they didn't take the heat for shaving off their beard, you know.
both Jerry Rubin and Abbie Hoffman ended up dying young for different reasons, but how did their relationship progress after the Yippie movement?
Well, you know, there's, you know, another sort of myth, I call it, is that, you know, that Jerry and Abbie hated each other. That wasn't the case at all. You know, when Abbie went underground for many years because he got busted for trying to sell cocaine to a cop or something. So throughout much of the 70s, Abbie was underground, and of course he trusted very few people. But one of the people he could trust was Jerry, and they had many clandestine meetings throughout the 70s. And Jerry was instrumental in getting Abbie back above ground, you know, helping him, you know. There was, you know, basically, eventually, you know, Abbie got some sort of amnesty for his so-called crimes. But, and so they were, you know, they were close, and then they did this, you know, Yippie versus Yuppie debate that some people thought was staged, and I wouldn't really call it stage, but there was still a closeness between the two men, for sure, even though their ideologies, you know, had drifted apart a bit.
We're speaking with Pat Thomas, and he's just written this beautiful coffee table book about Jerry Rubin called Did It, From Yippie to Yuppie, Jerry Rubin, an American Revolutionary. Talk a little bit about, Pat Thomas, talk a little bit about the trial.
Well, the Chicago Ed trial, I would say before the O.J. Simpson trial, was probably the most infamous trial in American history. What really happened, I mentioned earlier, you know, there was a lot of rioting on the streets of Chicago in 1968. Young people were trying to convince Hubert Humphrey and the Democratic Party to pull out of Vietnam. Mayor Daley of Chicago had a large police force, and he sent them out, and a lot of heads got cracked. And the funny thing is that the Democrats, as we all know, didn't even win the 68 election. It was won by Richard Nixon. And so Nixon decided that he wanted to prosecute these guys. And those were the days when the politics and the counterculture and musicians and poets like Allen Ginsberg, there was sort of a whole melting pot we don't really experience anymore of all these different movements. And so really that trial was almost a cultural trial. There were hippies at part of that trial, Black Panthers, a couple of college professors, an old pacifist. Several of these guys were Jewish, and so it was really sort of like putting the youth movement on trial. And it came very close to these guys being locked away. But what it really did is it sort of turned them into rock stars. Briefly, a lot of college kids of that era had posters of the Chicago Eight on their walls. Richard Avedon, the famous photographer, took photos of them. And it's important for us to remember that, again, to bring this into 2017, when, you know, we've got guys in Washington that are trying to do some weird, sleazy things. And again, there's sort of a parallel between the Nixon administration and the Trump administration, if you ask me.
You mentioned that you interviewed hundreds of people in the making of this, or at least over 100 people in making this book. Also, you've reprinted lots of memorabilia and personal items of Jerry Rubin. So how did you get the cooperation, and how did you find all these things?
Well, you know, I early on I reached out to Jerry Rubin. Died in 1994. He got hit by a car. And when he died, his family just kind of went into his apartment and just filled, except for his clothes and dishes, they took all of his journals, memorabilia. I mean, you know, Jerry was sort of a pack rat, and they just threw it in boxes. And I was pleasantly and disappointingly surprised to find out that I was the first person who ever wanted to look at this stuff. And so I gained their trust. I had written a book about the Black Panthers called Listen Whitey in 2012, and they were impressed by that book. And they literally, I moved in with Jerry Rubin's wife for 8 weeks, and I probably looked at about 10,000 things, letters from Yoko Ono, letters from the Weather Underground, letters from Eldridge Cleaver, letters between Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, you know, family photos going back to the 1930s. And so I realized I could create an incredible visual archive in this book, along with all of the interviews. And so it's a really fascinating thing. Again, even if Jerry Rubin himself doesn't mean much to you, if you grew up in the 60s and 70s and you had any interest at all in the counterculture, there's a wealth of great images in the book.
Absolutely. It's a beautiful book, and it's got lots in it, and it's called Did It, From Yippie to Yuppie, Jerry Rubin, an American Revolutionary. And the author, my guest, Pat Thomas. Pat, thank you so much for talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you. And I lived in San Francisco for 25 years. I love the whole Santa Cruz area. So I think the average Santa Cruz listener will probably find some curiosity here with this book.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guests, Mindy Johnson. She's the author of Ink and Paint, The Women of Walt Disney's Animation, and Pat Thomas. He's the author of Did It, From Yippie to Yuppie, Jerry Rubin, an American Revolutionary. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. We'll see you next time.